Good evening. Bernie endorses Biden.
I'm a president who has at least shown me that he is a racist and a sexist and a homophobe and a xenophobe and a religious bigot. I mean, for all of those reasons or more, we've got to make Trump a one-term president.
Cuomo says the worst is over, but it'll be months before a return to normalcy. Malnutrition haunts America's children, and an economist charts a way out. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with some of the news from Monday, April 13th, 2020. Nine states on the East and West Coast said on Monday they're planning for the slow reopening of their economies and lifting of stay-at-home orders amid signs the worst had passed in the U.S. coronavirus pandemic. But Governor Andrew Cuomo said while the worst is over, we're not out of the woods yet.
It has not overwhelmed the healthcare system. We have controlled the spread. And there is confidence to be taken in that. And that's an accomplishment. And it was a heck of an accomplishment. Those healthcare workers, for the rest of my life, I will say nothing but thank you to them. And I was not sure that we could keep the tide from overwhelming our hospital capacity. And they did. Feel good about that. And I believe the worst is over if we continue to be smart. And I believe we can now start on the path to normalcy. And we can have a plan where you start to see some businesses reopening, understanding the delicate balance. I think there'll become a point where there's an announcement that we have a medical treatment, that you can get sick, but they found an antiviral medication that can help you treat the disease. So take another deep breath when we get to that point, because, okay, you get infected, but there's a drug regimen that can help you. And then you'll get to a point where they announce, we have a proven vaccine. That's when it's over. That's really when it's over. They have a vaccine. It's been tested. It's been proven. They can produce it. You're going to get a vaccine. This is a thing of the past. Don't worry about it. Close the chapter. Move on. Okay, when do we get there? 12 months to 18 months. I can't believe you said 12 months to 18 months, as Cara said to me. It's 12 months to 18 months. When Dr. Fauci says how long until a vaccine, he says 12 months to 18 months. When the FDA is asked how long until you get a vaccine, they say 12 months to 18 months. That is the point. When you ask me, when can I do a deep breath for the first time in 5 weeks? When they say we have a vaccine, that's when it is over. But there will be points between now and then where we should feel more confident and we should feel better. Well, I want it to be over tomorrow. I get it. I want it to be over tomorrow. I want it to be over tomorrow more than you want it to be over tomorrow. But that's not reality. So let's calibrate our expectations. And in the meantime, stay the course.
Cuomo says he'll be working with New Jersey and Connecticut, will work with Delaware, Pennsylvania, and Rhode Island in coordinating gradually reopening their economies. The governors of California, Oregon, and Washington said they also had reached an agreement on a shared approach to restarting businesses, although they gave no firm timelines and said they would be guided by the health of residents first. The state decisions contradict President Donald Trump, who said earlier on Monday that any decision on restarting the economy was his to make. Trump tweeted Monday morning, "For the purpose of creating conflict and confusion, some in the fake news media are saying that it is the governor's decision to open up the states, not that of the president of the United States and the federal government. Let it be fully understood that this is incorrect." That's according to Trump this morning. Trump did not cite any particular legal authority. Legal experts say a U.S. president has limited power under the U.S. Constitution to order citizens back to their places of employment or cities to reopen government buildings, transportation, or local businesses to reopen. Meanwhile, Reuters news agency reported the U.S. death toll from COVID-19 topped 23,000 on Monday, with a total of nearly 570,000 cases. It reported on Sunday, it was reported that 1,513, the smallest increase since 1,309, died on April 16th. Oh, it was reported on Sunday. The largest number of fatalities, over 10,000, was in the New York State, was in New York State, with the concentration in and around New York City. Trump also denied he has plans to fire Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institutes of Health, a trusted member of the White House Coronavirus Task Force. Trump retweeted a message on Sunday from a former Republican congressional candidate who criticized Fauci's comments during a television interview and tweeted, "Time to fire Fauci." Trump was reportedly angry with earlier assertions by Fauci that the White House failed to move quickly at the outset of the crisis. Meanwhile, Rutgers University researchers have received U.S. government clearance for the first saliva test to help diagnose COVID-19. The Food and Drug Administration authorized a test under its emergency powers to quickly clear new tests and therapies to fight the outbreak. The announcement comes as communities across the U.S. continue to struggle with testing to help track and contain the coronavirus. Rutgers tested the accuracy of its method by taking both saliva and swab samples from 60 patients. The results from patients' saliva samples had a 100% match with results from the swabs. And the Trump administration wants to delay deadlines for the 2020 census because of the coronavirus outbreak, a move that, if approved, would push back timetables for releasing data used to draw congressional and legislative districts. Representative Carolyn Maloney said administration officials were asking that all field operations be postponed until June 1st and that the deadline for wrapping up the nation's headcount be pushed back until October 31st. Field operations for the 2020 census have been suspended since mid-March and were set to resume this week. And in political news, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who suspended his campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination last week, endorsed rival former Vice President Joe Biden in his attempt to win the nomination during a joint appearance by internet from their homes. Biden welcomed the endorsement.
My friend, Senator Bernie Sanders. Bernie, welcome.
Joe, thank you very much for your remarks, and thank you for welcoming me. To your live stream here. As you've indicated, we are living in an unbelievably unprecedented moment. You and I were chatting a few months ago, not in a million years would we have believed that we would be talking to each other in our respective homes, that we could not, you know, do rallies, that we could not get out of the house. We would not have believed that we'd be looking not only at a pandemic, which, as you indicated, has taken over 20,000 lives in our country, 500,000 people infected, but has cost us 16 million jobs. And that's probably a conservative number. The real number is probably higher than that. So we are in a terrible moment, an unprecedented moment. And I know we share the understanding that we've got to go forward right now and out of this in an unprecedented way to address the terrible pain that so many of our fellow Americans are feeling. So today I am asking all Americans, I'm asking every Democrat, I'm asking every Independent, I'm asking a lot of Republicans to come together in this campaign to support your candidacy, which I endorse, to make certain that we defeat somebody who I believe, and I'm speaking just for myself now, is the most dangerous president in the modern history of this country. A president, and you made this point, who downplayed this pandemic, who ignored the advice that some of his people were giving him, which has not, who has not used the Defense Production Act early on so that we could produce the masks, the gowns, the gloves, the ventilators that our medical personnel desperately need, who today, because I understand that is threatening to fire Dr. Fauci, who has been an unbelievable, I mean, it is, who has been day after day the voice of science to the American people trying to explain how we go forward in this crisis. And he's threatening to fire him. So to me, for all of those reasons and so many more, a president who doesn't, apparently has never read the Constitution of the United States, who believes he's above the law, a president who lies all of the time, a president who has at least shown me that he is a racist and a sexist and a homophobe and a xenophobe and a religious bigot. I mean, for all of those reasons or more, we've got to make Trump a one-term president, and we need you in the White House. So I will do all that I can to see that that happens, Joe. And I know that there is an enormous responsibility on your shoulders right now. And it's imperative that all of us work together to do what has to be done, not only in this moment, but beyond this moment, in the future of this country. You know very well that millions of our people are working for starvation wages. And one of the fights that I've been waging for a number of years now is to raise that minimum wage to at least $15 an hour. Is that something, Joe, that you are supportive of?
Bernie, I am extremely supportive of that. And I thank you for leading on it. I thank you for your endorsement, your support. But it means, look, it means a great deal to me personally. As I said in my statement, when you suspended your campaign, I want to thank you for being the powerful voice. And you've been the most powerful voice for a fair and more just America. It's a voice like yours that refuses to allow us just to accept what is. You've refused to accept that we can't change what's wrong in our nation. You refuse to accept that health and well-being of our fellow citizens and our planet isn't a responsibility of somebody else. It's our responsibility. Act now. And you don't get enough credit, Bernie, for being the voice that forces us to take a hard look in the mirror and ask ourselves, have we done enough? And we haven't. One issue you've led in the past is making sure that every single solitary thing we can do to keep workers whole during this crisis is a part of it. It goes well beyond the $15 an hour. As I said, more than 16 million, and you're right, it's probably significantly more than 16 million Americans have lost their jobs, because that's a lagging indicator. And Congress has appropriated more than $2.2 trillion in this last round of the so-called CARES Act. And my concern is the Trump administration is going to continue to do what it's always done. And that is, it's going to make sure the response in a way that the structural benefits go to the wealthy and the well-connected. And that's been your cry for a long time, Bernie. Basically, they're helping their friends. It isn't about the legislation. The legislation has been good. It's about how it's being implemented. The biggest, best-connected firms are getting assistance as fast as they can ask for it. Oversight and few conditions from Treasury and the Fed have been sort of wiped away. We should be imposing much stricter conditions on these big firms, telling them they only get the relief if they keep workers on their payroll, keep their jobs. Trump fired the Inspector General, I know you know this, who was put in place to police corporate corruption. And what's he trying to hide? Congress should demand answers, and I know you will. Meanwhile, the little guy, the mom-and-pop shops, the men and women, the minority-owned businesses, there have the fewest resources to fall back on in this crisis. And they're facing obstacles and delays that threaten their very existence of their businesses. But no one in Donald Trump's White House or Treasury is taking the kind of bold action required to make sure that those without prior wealth or prior connections get a priority. We should insist that the Trump White House and the Treasury Department move more aggressively to get those grants and loans to small businesses now, when they really need it. And if the banks won't do it, to go back to your point, they won't process the loans for small business regardless of their size, then the federal government should use their wartime authority to compel them to do so. Because otherwise, in 6 months, we're going to look back and see, this crisis has only made inequity worse in America. And I've said it from the beginning of our conversation. We just can't think about building back to the way things were before. That is not good enough. We need to build for a better future. And that's exactly what these task forces, your team and mine, have put together to focus on. I'll have a lot more to say about that, as you will too. But first, I want to thank you for your question. And Bernie, if I don't mind, Bernie, how do we, over the long haul, if I may ask, make sure we strengthen the economy?
Biden says both campaigns are putting together several task forces purposed to find common ground on issues during the campaign. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. But even as state governments grapple with how to reopen the economy, members of Congress are warning that child hunger has been skyrocketing during the combined health and economic crisis, with 37% of parents nationwide cutting the size of meals or skipping meals for their children because they did not have enough money for food in the last month. The CEO of Hunger Free America is Joel Berg.
There are 400 sites in New York City where parents can pick up food for their kids and themselves, and that's a lot. But compare that to 1,600 schools that are in operation on a daily basis. New York City schools, on a normal day, serve nearly a million meals a day, more than any entity in America other than the Pentagon. And so even though there are heroic efforts going on now to find alternative meal delivery systems, they're only scratching the surface of the need.
How about supply? Is there a supply chain problem?
By and large, for people with money, they can find food. The greatest challenge remains for the vast numbers of New Yorkers who just don't have enough money to buy food, even if it is on the shelves near them.
And what's causing this? What's behind this problem?
We had a vast hunger epidemic when times were still good. Now that we've lost nearly a million meals a day, now that probably hundreds of thousands of New York parents, and possibly even more, are unemployed, now that thousands of senior centers or hundreds of senior centers citywide serving tens of thousands of seniors are closed down, we took a bad situation and went worse, got worse. I know worser isn't a word, but we went from worse to worser because everything that could go wrong has gone wrong.
Are they the babies crying? Is there malnutrition? Is there any? Are we going to see things that you see in poor countries?
If this goes on much longer, we're going to see the malnutrition you do see in the developing world. And I point out the hunger crisis is directly tied to the healthcare crisis. When you are malnourished, your immune system is less robust, and so people who are skipping meals are probably more likely to both contract COVID-19 and transmit COVID-19. We're never going to fix the healthcare problem unless we ensure that New Yorkers and all Americans are better nourished.
Everything is tied together. What's your solution?
The best solution is to get more people help with the SNAP program, what used to be called the food stamps program, and the WIC program, so people can shop for the food they need. There are far more commercial retail outlets in New York City than there are soup kitchens and food pantries. They generally have a better stock of food. And when you buy things, either with cash or with SNAP or WIC benefits at a supermarket or a farmer's market, you're helping keep those stores in business. Now, I'm very, very, very worried about the health care conditions of the workers at those stores, but assuming they can be protected, at least if you're shopping at them, you are helping keeping those workers in their jobs, which is the single best way to stave off hunger, making sure that as many people as possible still have incomes to buy food.
And what about SNAP? What's going on with that now?
The Trump administration has yet to approve an application for New York State for so-called pandemic EBT that would give food to 1.6 million children statewide. That would provide over $800 million worth of food, but the Trump administration has still not approved the state of New York's proposal for that, and the Trump administration has not used what's called disaster SNAP in any state in the union since this started. It was used widely after hurricanes and other natural disasters. It was used after 9/11. Why they're not using it and why not making these existing federal benefits more available to people is really beyond me. And lastly, the Republicans are staunchly opposing increasing existing SNAP programs. We put out a statement today on our new national poll about skyrocketing hunger in New York and America, and both Senator Schumer and Senator Gillibrand were quoted in our press release about the need for us to increase SNAP benefits. The proposal we're talking about would increase benefits by 20 cents a meal. 20 cents a meal. The average SNAP benefit now is $1.34 per meal nationwide. We would raise it to the princely sum of $1.54 per meal. But that 20 cents a meal is just too much for the Republicans, apparently. And the $2 trillion stimulus package, the extra money for SNAP, for food aid to low-income Americans, would have been 1% of the entire package, and they vetoed that. So I'm very glad that the Democrats are standing up and saying the next round of aid has to include food aid.
And that's what's behind the conflict right now over passing these the small business loans.
part of it's conflict over SNAP, part of it's conflict over making sure that the small business loans better aid the restaurant industry. They're not particularly structured in a way that's good to help them. We want to make sure that unemployment compensation can truly go to a wide variety of people. So some in the media portraying the fight between the Democrats and the Republicans now over the new stimulus bill as nothing more than sort of a shallow political infighting. It is a deep and vital battle of conscience over whether 36 million Americans who rely on SNAP food aid will get extra money into their grocery cart. So this isn't about petty politics. This is a very dramatic confrontation on a matter of very high principle.
Joel Berg is CEO of Hunger Free America. In an open letter to Congress titled A Critical Care Bailout for Main Street in the Face of COVID-19, How Public Banks Can Reboot the Real Economy, progressive economists say there are actions that will prevent financial catastrophe in our communities and set them up for future fiscal health. Ellen Brown is founder of Public Banking Institute. She says returning control of money and credit to states and communities is at the heart of the plan.
We've got a huge $4 trillion bailout for corporate America, but there's not much being done for the people other than $1,200 once and then some unemployment benefits. So we're proposing a universal basic income, not just once, but regularly. You have this periodic booms and busts where debt goes up, up, up until it all collapses. And then that goes around and around and around. And you can avoid that by filling that gap. Number two, to get payment immediately into the hands of the people. You have to $1,200 if you have to wait 4 months, like if you don't have a bank account, which 25% of people either are unbanked or underbanked. So the proposals, all you have to do is just open up another window at your post office. Post offices are everywhere. The Fed would deliver the Treasury would deliver these $1,200 payments through the post offices, and you could go there and access it and get your money. So that's one option. And the other option was the Treasury Direct, which is something that's already set up by the Treasury, and it's a place where you can, so that could be used for immediate payments. And then point number three was to set up public banks, publicly owned banks, because the Federal Reserve is now making 0% interest loans. I mean, it's 0 to 0.25%, but effectively it's 0% loans to banks. And if we want to access that as a state or a local government, we can do it by setting up our own public banks on the model of the Bank of North Dakota, our one and only state-owned bank at the moment. If you have an existing loan fund, if you called that capital, you could then make 10 times that many loans. You can leverage your capital. So that's something a depository bank can do that a loan fund can't do. So you could greatly magnify the amount of credit that you have available for all those very needy projects that state and municipal governments have right now. And then the fourth point was to cancel debts. The way the ancients used to do it was ancient kings and would just have periodic debt jubilees, because you always have this debt buildup that's bigger. Debt grows faster than the money supply. You do need to get the debts off the books somehow in order to rescue all those people that are now drowning in debt, including students, and credit card debt is very heavy. A lot of mortgages are underwater, et cetera. So what you can do is move the debts off the books of the banks onto the books of the Federal Reserve. In the same way that the Fed bought mortgage-backed securities, they can now buy asset-backed securities. And they're actually doing that through these special purpose vehicles that they've set up.
What does it mean, inflationary, just briefly, inflationary pressure? What is that?
It really was the federal government and the state governments that have brought the economy to a grinding halt. So they really do need to bail out everybody. This is not inflationary. All you're doing is replacing the credit that used to be there that is suddenly no longer there. And this is particularly apparent with municipal governments, that they fund their debt by selling bonds on the open market. Well, all of a sudden, nobody wants the municipal bonds. I mean, nobody wants anything. They're dumping everything, but including the municipal bonds, which means the price is going up, 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 like the interest rate. If you wanted to do a new issue of bonds, you would have to pay quite a bit more. And it's not the fault of the municipal government. That's something that could be bailed out just by buying a municipal bond vehicle, I think. Anyway, the Federal Reserve, through the Treasury are, and the Federal Reserve are now partnering, and through this special purpose vehicle, they will now buy municipal bonds. But that's not going to put extra money in the system. It's only going to replace those buyers that used to be there and have all of a sudden dumped the bond.
And what's helicopter money?
You just fly over the economy and drop money from helicopters. In other words, just print money and get it out there because the money supply has shrunk. So you just got to fill the bucket back up.
Are we going to run up, as they used to say, a gigantic multi-trillion dollar deficit that our children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren will have to pay off? Is that true?
No, not as long as the Federal Reserve buys the debt and holds the debt. As long as there's no, it's the interest that goes up and up. We never pay off the federal debt. I mean, we've got a $22 trillion federal debt. When I was born, we had a federal debt. That's never been paid off, and I never felt the pinch, and I'm pretty old. Right now, we owe $565 billion in interest. So that's the thing that keeps going up. And if the Federal Reserve holds the debt, and rolls, you know, agrees, if they make a deal with Congress saying we're not going to sell this back into the open market, we're going to hold it, and the Federal Reserve already gives their interest back to the Treasury. That's what they're required to do, is return their profits to the Treasury after deducting their costs. So it's already essentially interest-free, anything that's on the Fed's books.
A friend of mine who's a politician says the government can afford anything that the laws of physics allow.
Right. Oh, I agree with that. The objection, of course, is if you're printing it and it's going into asset bubbles, then it will drive the price up. Like if you print it and it goes into housing in New York, which there's a great shortage of, so there's no choice but for the price to go up, up, up. That will drive up the price. But as long as you can use the money to produce things, so your supply is going up with demand, then the money supply will remain stable. Or if the money is not being spent, like if you gave it to people right now as a universal basic income, they are so desperate for money, they're not going to rush out and spend twice what they used to spend. They'll be lucky to rush out and spend what they're used to spending, like on food and rent and all that stuff. They'll be saving the rest because 80% of the population lives paycheck to paycheck, basically has no real savings.
Do you expect from the president administration the type of sophistication that you need to put something like this into place?
That's why I write. You know, there's always the hope that somebody will pay attention and read it. I mean, I guess the way I see it is like you can see these answers and you just hope to be able to enlighten enough people that something will actually happen with those answers. We the people obviously have very little control over our politicians.
And Ellen Brown is founder of the Public Banking Institute. And finally, a sailor from the U.S. aircraft carrier stricken with the novel coronavirus has died from complications related to COVID-19, according to the Navy. The sailor from the USS Theodore Roosevelt was declared dead Monday after being taken to an intensive care unit last week. CPR was administered by fellow sailors of the on-site medical team in an isolation house before the sailor was transferred to the ICU at the U.S. Naval Hospital in Guam. The coronavirus outbreak aboard the Roosevelt has turned into a political firestorm after the ship's former commander, Captain Brett Crozier, wrote a letter pleading for permission to offload most of the ship's crew. And that's some of the news for Monday, April 13th, 2020. The news was produced by Linda Perry, our engineer, the great Reggie Johnson, who is going to entreat you all to go out to your windows at 7 o'clock and cheer for our health workers. And for the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.